good. I know. Shane, would you go see if the officer, here he comes. The third case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Patrick John Thielson. For the appellant, Mr. Thielson, we have Timothy Borman, an attorney from Falkton. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, we have Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general. Now, Mr. Borman, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to start by apologizing. I'm hoping you'll be able to hear me. I didn't get my flu shot, and I'm paying for it now. But if I get too quiet, please let me know.
Well, we just didn't have you keep your distance, then.
I can back up at any given time.
My name. You have a glass of water. You're certainly allowed to bring one up to the podium if you want one.
I'll probably just dribble it down my front. So we'll just let it go. My name is Tim Borman. I'm here today representing Patrick Thielson. Mr. Thielson was charged with first-degree murder in the death of Kelly Ryan on November 1, 2001, and second-degree rape of Tasha John Honor about September 26, 2001. Mr. Thielson is currently serving a life sentence without parole and also a 25-year sentence on the rape in the South Dakota State Penitentiary.
Give me the dates again. When was the alleged crime, and when was the
rape was on or about September 26th of 2001, and the murder was November 1st of 2001. This appeal arises from circumstances surrounding the plea agreement that Mr. Thielson entered with the Brown County State's Attorney, which has him currently serving this time. He entered into that plea agreement on November 12, 2002, after his case had been proceeding for just about a year. November 12th was the date set for the jury trial on the rape charge. Now, prior to that, I'm going to back up to give a little background. On November 11th, Mr. Thielson was in the state penitentiary. At about 10 a.m. on the morning of November 11th, he was taken from his regular cell, transported to what they call the hard cell. To give you a visual, the hard cell is 8 by 10 feet, bare concrete floor. There's a mattress which is on a raised poured block of concrete in the cell, toilet. When residing in the hard cell, an inmate is not allowed to wear their regular prison uniform. Instead, they are put in a blue gown, similar to the gown you would wear when a patient in a hospital. Roughly, to be in the hard cell equates to being on a suicide watch in the penitentiary. He spent the majority of the day, November 11th, in that hard cell. Later in the day, he was allowed to change back into his prison uniform. He was secured with ankle chains, belly chain, handcuffs, a black box, which is a security device over top of the handcuffs, and transported to Aberdeen for the hearing the next day. Once in Aberdeen, he was put into the Brown County Jail, and there he was held in a holding cell. The holding cell in the Brown County Jail is 6 foot by 9 foot, again, bare concrete floors. There is no water or toilet in that cell, and there is only one light bulb, which burns 24 hours a day. Those were his living conditions leading up to the hearing on November 12th. At 8 a.m. on the morning of the 12th, he was taken to be allowed to shower, put on a suit of clothes which his wife had brought him for his court appearance, and he was resecured with handcuffs and also a leg brace. From there, he went to meet with his defense team and his wife, and they began talking to him about a plea bargain or a plea offer from the Brown County State's Attorney, which in essence is what he wound up taking in exchange for pleading guilty to the first degree murder and the second degree rape charge. The state would then be dropping other charges of attempted escape, an aggravated assault, and another rape charge.
Well, most importantly, though, he avoided the death penalty.
That was part of it, and
that's a pretty good deal, isn't it? Your life.
That was the consensus of his defense team and also his wife, that there would be no escaping from the death penalty or even more so if he were to go forward with the jury trials, he would be looking at a cumulative sentence in years that would amount to life anyway. I guess they considered it to be the lesser of two evils. Now, it's important to note that over the course of the year that this case went on, plea offers of this sort had been brought to Mr. Thielson by his defense attorneys on separate occasions, and every time he made it very clear that he wanted no part of a plea bargain, of a plea offer. He maintained his innocence. He maintained that he had not done this, that he had not done what he had been accused of.
November 12th was the day set for trial, wasn't it?
November 12th was the day set for the commencement of the jury trial on the rape, the second-degree rape charge, which was related to the Tasha Judd incident. The charges on Kelly Ryan, which would have been the murder, rape, aggravated assault, and attempted escape, that jury trial was not set to commence until March of 2003.
But was there a jury in the courthouse that day?
There was a jury out there prepared to go, yes.
Thank you, I'm sorry.
One question. Go ahead.
Can I ask if?
Go ahead.
Did the state have a strong case against him in either one or both of these two upcoming trials?
From the state's point of view, yes. Obviously, they felt they had a strong case.
But even his lawyers conceded that they had a strong case, at least one.
His defense team did feel that they had a strong case, but they also did make mention, and it is in the record, primarily in the private conference transcript, that there were matters that came up in discovery and pieces of evidence that had not been fully explored, including some matters of DNA evidence, which they wanted to check into further, some statements that Mr. Thielson had made before being represented by counsel. There were other matters that they wanted to look into. I wouldn't go so far as to call them huge inconsistencies, but there are details which should have been further explored.
Had they ever brought a suppression motion to suppress any admissions or statements or anything of that nature at that point?
To the best of my knowledge, they had not at that point in time. I think the majority of the suppression motions which would have come would have been part of the murder trial, which was not set for a matter of another 4 months. And they were dealing first and foremost with the rape case. But I can't answer for sure whether or not suppression motions had been taken on the rape case. I don't remember that. I can check into that.
But isn't before they enter a plea, though, to the whole bail of wax, wasn't it important to determine the suppression motions on the murder case?
I would assume that would have been the way it should have been done. I was not privy to a lot of the discussions on how they went about some of this. I was appointed to this well after the fact. But my assumption would be that they had looked at motions of that sort, and basically the defense counsel that Mr. Thielson had felt that this was a good offer to have on the table at the last minute going into a jury trial. They visited with Mr. Thielson's wife. Mr. Thielson's wife visited with him. His defense team visited with him. I believe even his investigator was there for the defense counsel. They visited with Mr. Thielson, urging him that he was in a situation where it's better to take the known evil of the life sentence without parole than to face the unknown of the capital punishment and anything else that may come down the pike if he were to go into trial on these charges.
Remind me of the names of the defense counsel again.
That would be Leon Vanderlinden or Lonnie, Tom Sinise, both from Webster, and William Gurdis from Aberdeen.
And they also had as a consultant Mark Meyer-Henry, too.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you've got three veteran trial attorneys and Gurdis, Vanderlinden, and Meyer-Henry involved in this.
Yes.
The relief, if you win, I guess, is the state gets another run at him on the death penalty, correct?
That's correct, and that is something that I brought to Mr. Thielson's attention when this entire process began. There is supporting case law, I don't have it in front of me, that says that on something of this sort, there's nothing to bar the state from re-going after the capital punishment, the death penalty. He has been informed of that fact. He still, at this point in time, maintains that he feels the evidence will ultimately prove that he did not commit these crimes, and he's willing to take his chances.
At the time of the plea agreement, he was only going to go to trial on the rape, right?
That's correct.
The death case was in the spring.
Yep, that was scheduled for 4 months after in March.
Was the deal contingent on the trial in the rape? In other words, if you don't plead guilty now, if we have to try the rape case, the deal isn't going to be on the table?
I'm not sure if the prosecution ever made that clear. I believe they just had offered him this deal prior to the rape case. I think if they would have gone ahead with the jury trial, they still may have offered him some form of a deal later on the murder trial prior
so
to it.
He could have rolled the dice on the rape case to see how it went.
I am not 100% sure whether or not it was ever said this is a one-time offer, take it or leave it. My review of the records from the defense counsel don't reflect that. My feeling is that the atmosphere that Mr. Thielson was involved in at the time that they brought this offer to him was one that, with the way he had been living prior to this hearing, the hard cell in the penitentiary, the holding cell in the Brown County Jail, the being tossed and turned, his wife there, it put him in a state of mental distress, which made it relatively difficult for him to be able to form a coherent thought about what he was doing.
But it's 2 days of that kind of living, right?
Excuse me?
2 days. The 11th of Penn.
Yes, it started on the 11th. All of this took place on the morning of the 12th. So it was basically about a 24-hour period to when he was making these decisions.
Now, if I understand you correctly, even though this particular offer came the morning of the trial, there had been similar type offers from the state prior to this, which he'd rejected. So he did have quite a bit of time to think about, do I want to roll a dice or do I want to go with that life sentence?
At least twice prior to this, he had received offers that I know of, yes.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
When Mr. Thielson's defense team approached him with this offer, they talked it over. They agreed that they would go with it. They then made an appearance in front of Judge Von Wald, talking about how he would be accepting a plea offer. He was advised of his rights. Court went into recess while a factual basis was prepared. Mr. Thielson was left alone during that time in a meeting room in the courthouse with his wife. A lot of conversation going on, according to Mr. Thielson, according to some statements that conversations I've had with his wife regarding what the publicity of a trial would do to the family, to their children, that nature of discussion. When the factual basis was brought in, Mr. Thielson signed the signature page, did not thoroughly review it, although he did attest to having reviewed it. It was then entered in to the record later in the afternoon. They read it into the record, questioned him on it, and set sentencing for the 21st of November.
Are you suggesting that the signed agreement contained significant consequences for him that were not contained in the oral offer, life in prison?
No, I think basically the factual basis that he signed reflected the oral offer that was being offered. It's our contention that Mr. Thielson just was not thinking clearly about the ramifications of what he was doing. After factual basis was entered in on the record, sentencing was scheduled for the 21st. Mr. Thielson was first returned to the holding cell in the Brown County Jail, then transferred back to the South Dakota State Penitentiary, where he was placed on a 48-hour suicide watch back in the hard cell.
Does the record show why he was placed on suicide watch?
It is. The record does not show it. My research has shown that it is a common procedure at the state penitentiary for individuals who have entered a plea to a life sentence or a major thing of that sort. The overall stress that they are under from making such a decision or going through such an ordeal, to be on safety side, they want to put them where they can be observed more easily for the first time back.
So it wasn't based on any particular circumstance peculiar to him. It was just basically their policy that anyone who went through this.
It was their policy that people who have gone through this usually are distressed, and they want to put them into an observation or a place where observation is made more adequate and simple.
Is that what your case comes down to, simply that this defendant was under stress and therefore he should be able to withdraw his plea. If we simplified it, is that essentially what you're asking?
But in the simplest terms, yes. He was distraught. He was distressed. There were mental pressures on him from his defense counsel, from his wife. There were physical pressures physical discomfort in the way that he was restrained in his treatment leading up to entering the plea. And all of those combined made it difficult for him to form a rational thought in what he was accepting.
But there isn't any medical evidence to indicate that he was unable to do so.
There were never any psychological profiles or any medical evidence that was presented or that Mr. Thielson underwent to support that. No, there isn't.
Well, should we then rule in your favor in this case? Any defendant, under any circumstances, as long as they say I was stressed out, they're going to be able to withdraw their plea, are they not?
That'd be nice, but we can't say that. I mean, the statutory law does...
That's what you're asking us to essentially say, isn't it?
In a way it is. But
you don't have a case like Engelman where he was under medication, which would have affected his ability to consider these things.
Right. Mr. Thielson was not on medication. However, this case does relate to Engelman on a few levels. In Engelman, as also in a couple of the other cases that I mentioned in the brief, State versus Bolger, State versus Lonas, one of the things that this court has said is that you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. Now, when you start with just the basic law of withdrawing a plea, it'd be South Dakota Codified Law 23A-2711, a motion to withdraw a plea of guilty may be made before sentence is imposed or imposition of sentence is suspended. Mr. Thielson did that. Admittedly, he prepared a pro se motion to withdraw his plea. The evidence on it was lacking. When the court had the hearing on it, Judge Von Wald did question him. He was not prepared adequately to offer supporting evidence for that motion. He was unable to articulate it at the time. But much like every case that has been heard on this instance, it was before the sentence was imposed. There was no clear-cut prejudice offered to the state by his motion to withdraw the plea. The state was prepared to proceed with the trial, the jury trial. It still would have been prepared had they withdrawn the plea.
What, was he assisted by counsel when he wished to withdraw his plea?
He was not. He basically prepared his motion to withdraw his plea pro se using an acquaintance in the penitentiary and
a book. When he came before the judge, I understand he prepared it pro se, but when he came back for the hearing on his plea withdrawal, was he assisted by counsel then?
He was assisted to a point. A review of the transcript will show that he offered it up. There were some off-the-record discussions to try and get him to offer some testimony. There was some directed questioning to him to allow him to try and explain a little bit further. Some of the matters they discussed were the conditions in which he was transported, which he was living prior to the incident. Those were some of the issues that were touched on.
And of course, he wanted to fire his lawyers and get new lawyers.
Yes, that was another pro se motion that he sent along with it to dismiss his counsel. Mr. Thielson felt that they had been inadequate through study or through reading that he did. He came to the conclusion that there would have been a possibility that he felt perhaps his attorney should have directed him to enter an Elford plea like that seen in State versus Engelman. Basically a plea which allows you to say, well, I'm saying I'm guilty, but I maintain my innocence because all the evidence isn't in yet.
But that wasn't part of the plea offer.
No, that was not. That's the contention that Mr. Thielson has at this time. He did not feel that his counsel, he felt that his defense counsel was basically under the assumption he had no chance of winning and were not working hard for him. I guess that would boil down to be the simplest form of why he wanted to dismiss his attorneys at that point in time.
Doesn't a competent attorney owe his client the obligation to level with the client as far as the client's chances if he goes to trial?
Absolutely. I guess maybe leveling wasn't something that he wanted to hear. But at the same time, he did feel that they were not working to their utmost for his benefit. And that was a concern of Mr. Thielson's going into the motions that he presented to the court. Those would have been heard on November 21st. We're talking of a matter of 9 days after he entered the plea agreement. In that time, in the state penitentiary, Mr. Thielson was able to articulate his views into pro se motions, to withdraw his plea, to also dismiss his counsel. He did offer them to the court in a timely fashion prior to sentencing. He did comply with what codified law needs. The question at hand is whether or not the totality of the circumstances would support having that motion granted. In this case, the motion was denied. And that's why we are here asking that be reviewed to see if the discretion was abused. I see I'm out of time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Blum. Before we continue on, I should note, and I should have noted at the beginning, Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Max Gores, presiding judge of the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in her place. Mr. Geegan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. As you know from reading the briefs and listening to Mr. Borman here today, the sole issue raised on appeal is whether the defendant should have been allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. The record reflects that the defendant appeared before the court on November 12th of 2002 for purposes of a change of plea hearing. Pursuant to the plea agreement reached with the state, the defendant pled guilty to first-degree murder and second-degree rape. As Mr. Borman pointed out, in exchange for that plea, the state dismissed other charges that were then pending against the defendant and further agreed not to pursue the death penalty. In his reply brief, the defendant argues that the facts have little or no bearing on the true crux of this appeal, that being whether he entered his plea while in a state of mental distress. The defendant wants his court to focus solely on his alleged mental anguish stemming from the pressures supposedly asserted by his wife and defense counsel and the substandard living conditions that he was allegedly subjected to. The state can certainly understand the defendant's reluctance to discuss the hideous nature of the crimes committed and pled guilty to, but needless to say, the state does not agree with counsel's assessment that the facts have no bearing on the present appeal, especially considering the defendant's assertions in his reply brief that the evidence does not point to him as a guilty party and that there is still evidence which would support his innocence. The state, therefore, would like to take just a brief moment to comment on the factual basis underlying the defendant's guilty plea. As was indicated by the trial court, those facts will show, in fact, how despicable, Mr. Thielson, you are, in fact, as a person.
Aren't people who commit despicable crimes entitled to a jury trial?
Certainly.
And isn't the jury trial the bedrock of our system of justice in this country and this state?
I guess what it boils down to is whether or not there's any factual support in the records for the defense assertion that he was coerced or pressured into accepting the plea offer made by the state.
If the state's got such a good case, why does it care if he has a jury trial?
It's typical in a case such as this to make a plea offer. I guess it was totally up to the defendant whether or not he accepted the offer made by the state.
In fact, the state would now get a chance to put him to death if it's allowed to be withdrawn.
True, but I guess on a counter consideration is the time and expense involved in the trial.
But that's what the customers get in this country, a trial, no matter how guilty you are. And that's one of the costs that the state has agreed to bear in its constitution.
So was it your position then that a plea agreement is never a viable option for the defendant?
Oh, I didn't say that. But if he wants to have a trial, why shouldn't he get one? Even if he made a well or an ill-advised decision to plead guilty earlier, as long as he hasn't been sentenced yet, why not just let him withdraw his plea and have a trial?
Because the precedents have been set. There's no question, if you review the transcripts, the plea that was entered by the defendant was knowing and intelligent. This court has indicated that in determining whether or not a defendant should be allowed to withdraw that plea, the court should look at the reasons why that withdrawal was sought. Various factors that have been identified by this court include actual innocence, whether the plea was contrary to the truth, misapprehension of the facts, incorrect advice from counsel, and whether the plea was obtained through force or coercion. This court has repeatedly indicated that there's no absolute right to withdraw the plea once it's entered.
But you do have, we have said repeatedly too, that the right is should be liberally granted. Before sentencing, we are to liberally grant that right to withdraw.
True, but this court has also said that the withdrawal of a guilty plea, even prior to sentencing, is not subject to the mere whim or caprice of the defendant. Instead, the withdrawal of the plea before imposition of sentence remains entrusted to the sound discretion of the trial court. The state would submit that in this particular case, the defendant failed to establish to the trial court's satisfaction any persuasive reasons why he should be allowed to withdraw that plea. If you look at the record, the defendant made only fleeting reference to his purported innocence. When he was questioned by defense counsel whether he was maintaining his innocence to the charges, the defendant's response was yes, nothing more. Such a self-serving statement does not provide sufficient grounds for withdrawal of the plea. The trial court, in the instant case, found that the defendant's defense team, comprised of three attorneys, experts, and an investigator, had spent months investigating this case, attempting to collect evidence which would support a defense.
But they didn't give him much help when it came time to ask to withdraw the plea, did they?
Yes, if you look at the transcripts, the decision whether or not to enter the plea was left entirely up to the defendant.
I understand that. I'm talking about when he went in to withdraw. They didn't help him much then, did they?
Yes, they did. If you look at the transcripts, defense pro se motion, he was specifically questioned by the court whether he wanted to put on any evidence in support of his motion, whether he wanted to make a record. Defendant's response to the trial court was no, he wanted to stand on the motion. It was only at defense counsel's urging that he take the stand and testify. Under the circumstances, counsel attempted to represent the defendant to the best of their capabilities.
Was he the only witness?
At the suppression hearing?
At the motion
to withdraw? Yes.
Okay.
He put on no other testimony in support of his request to withdraw his guilty plea.
And the state had no witnesses at all?
No.
Did the state know this motion was coming?
It was a pro se motion. My recollection of the record is that it was filed on the eve of sentencing when he appeared for what was scheduled for a sentencing hearing.
Any of the defense counsel argue for him after he testified?
I believe that under circumstances, they did make an argument to the court based on his testimony regarding the stress that the defendant maintained that he was under. But if we get back to the trial court's assessment, the trial court indicated that the three attorneys appointed to represent the defendant had been on board in this case for about 12 months. They have all expended a substantial number of hours and time dedicated to investigating the facts, investigating the evidence that the state has, investigating through either their efforts or the efforts of an investigator appointed by the court, or through other experts, any evidence that would relate to the guilt or innocence of the defendant.
How about the fact that they failed to bring a suppression motion on the murder trial?
I believe if you look at the transcripts of the private conference with the defendant on the morning in question, counsel had indicated that was one of the possibilities, but the consensus amongst the three attorneys seemed to be that a suppression motion would likely be unsuccessful. Based on the fact that the defendant had been read his Miranda rights prior to the interview, he had waived his Miranda rights, and it was the fact that it was the defendant who subsequently made the request to see the officer. He initiated or instigated the subsequent interview with the police.
Are the discussions between the defense attorneys and the defendants, is there a transcript of that?
The private conference?
Yes.
Yes, there is.
All right. I know Mr. Gerdes has done that in the past, and so we can actually read.
Fortunately, counsel had the foresight to have a court reporter present, and the state's position that if you review that transcript, there's no indication whatsoever therein that counsel attempted to force or coerce the defendant into entering into a guilty plea. In fact, before being asked to sign his sworn statement, defense counsel specifically asked the defendant whether it was his desire to enter into the plea, and he responded in the affirmative. Subsequent to that meeting, the defendant then appeared before the court for his change of plea hearing. Prior to accepting his plea, the court again undertook to advise the defendant of his constitutional statutory rights. Now, throughout that entire exchange, The defendant informed the court that he understood what he was doing. The trial court also specifically had the state's attorney set out on the record the terms of the plea agreement. The defendant, when asked if he was agreeable to complying with the same, responded, yes, sir. The trial court also on the record questioned the defendant whether anyone had threatened you, forced you, or intimidated you in any way to get you to enter a certain plea in this case. Based on the responses given by the defendant, the trial court had no difficulty in finding that he was acting of his own free will without any undue influence or duress. The state would submit that there's absolutely no support in the record for the defendant's assertions that he received incorrect advice from counsel in regard to whether or not he should accept a guilty plea. The trial court in the instant case stated that for all practical purposes, the defendant had the benefit of 4 experienced attorneys who have been involved in similar cases in the past, and they have given you the advice that they thought was appropriate.
Now let's back up a minute. This transcribed discussion between the defense attorneys and the defendant, I take it then there's no prosecutor in the room, no judge, nobody but the defendant and
defendant,
his attorneys.
3 attorneys, court reporter, and the defendant's wife.
All right.
That transcript also serves to negate the defendant's assertions that he was forced into accepting a guilty plea by his wife. According to the defendant, he was confronted by his crying and distraught wife prior to the hearing, and she told him that she didn't want him to go to a trial because of the pre-trial publicity. That transcript, however, does not bear out the assertions made by the defendant. While his wife was present during the meeting, there's no indication that she attempted to make any emotional demands on the defendant in order to influence him to enter a guilty plea. In fact, if you look at the transcripts, the trial court specifically noted, the court would indicate for the record that on November 12th, in the hearing held at 10:40 in the morning, the court did not note any problems or indication that the defendant was emotionally upset in any manner. Defense counsel in this case, after reviewing the facts and evidence, made an informed judgment that would be in the defendant's best interest to accept a guilty plea. They attempted to explain to the defendant on the morning in question that the purpose behind entering into such a plea was to avoid the issue of capital punishment and a possible death sentence. They told the defendant, one of the primary reasons that we have urged that, beyond what we view as the strength of the state's case, is the likelihood of a not guilty verdict on both the rape charges as well as the murder charge, is the fact that Pant, in our view, has virtually no chance of being found not guilty of either attempted escape or aggravated assault. It was their belief that based on the potential sentences that could be imposed in connection with the other charges, the reality was that the defendant was going to be in a penitentiary for the rest of his life.
Can you answer the question that came up earlier? Was the plea offer that he had to plead to this rape that was going to be tried that morning in order to get the full benefit, or could he have waited and rolled the dice?
I don't believe there's any indication in the transcript of that, whether or not it was contingent upon his accepting it immediately or if he had gone to trial on the rape charges as the plea was off the table.
Now, if I understand correctly, he would have been facing life sentence on the rape if convicted on that.
Right. Based on his prior history, his prior rape conviction in 1994, based on the rape charges, based on the attempted escape charges, based on aggravated assault charges, constantly determined that's what was going to happen anyway, and in their opinion, what the plea did was avoid the possibility of a death sentence.
Okay. So the state, if its goal was life imprisonment, all it needed to do based on the scheduling was convict him of the rape.
And they
really never needed to go to the murder trial.
Exactly. Rape and the attempted escape and aggravated assault charges.
All right.
And the police officer also factored into.
But this, if I recall correctly, and help me here, it seems that the evidence against him in the murder case was far stronger than the evidence against him in the rape case. Is that right, or I have it backwards?
The evidence in the rape case consisted of eyewitness accounts, i.e. the victim, Tasha Jett. She had gone into pretty graphic detail as far as what transpired in the afternoon of September 26th when the defendant had stopped and asked her to go with him to an unknown location to retrieve a vehicle of his.
It was an issue of whether she had consented.
There was no issue of consent.
There was not, okay.
As far as the murder charges, after talking with the victim of the rape charges, Tasha Judd, the police went to the area where she'd been raped by the defendant, and while conducting a search, recovered numerous articles, including a sock which was later determined to contain semen stains. Tests on that sock determined that the defendant was a potential or likely donor. Also recovered at that scene was a towel which was later identified as having been taken from Ms. Ryan's residence. That towel contained blood stains which was determined to match the blood type of the victim. I guess what this case boils down to, and in closing, I'd like to quote a portion from the defendant's reply brief where he appears to concede that the record does not support the assertions now being made in support of his request to withdraw the guilty plea. He maintains that attempts to make the decision that his frame of mind is correctly conveyed through the transcripts is what he refers to as a frivolous task. According to the defendant, it is impossible to construct the full range of pressures he was subjected to based solely on those transcripts. He argues that those transcripts do not convey a true picture of his mental workings, given his inability to vocalize his distress when he appeared in front of the trial court, while indicating that the facts supposedly exist somewhere between the record and the transcripts, the defendant asked this court to nonetheless find that they exist anyway. I guess what the defendant is asking this court to do is simply take his word for it and decide this appeal based on what the lower court characterized as nothing more than bald assertions. Unfortunately for the defendant, the appellate rules of advocacy don't provide for that. The burden is on a defendant to provide an adequate record for this court to review. Absent that record, the presumption must be that the trial court acted correctly.
Of course, he's with a little bit of a handicap. Since this is a direct appeal, you can't put his attorneys on the stand or anything. He's pretty well limited to what was said in the arraignment.
There was never any request either by defendant or through his attorneys at the time of the withdrawal hearing asked for a continuance so he could present medical testimony to support his alleged distress defense. Unless there's any further questions, the state would close by asking that this court affirm the trial court's denial of the defendant's request to withdraw the guilty plea.
Thank you, Mr. Geagan.
Thank you.
Mr. Borman, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. The state, rightly so, wants to talk about the serious nature of the crimes that led to this. However, the point of this appeal is not those crimes. The point of this appeal is the fact that Mr. Thielson offered a motion to withdraw his plea. That motion was denied. That's what he is seeking a judgment on. There are just a couple of things I want to state here. The state has made it clear that you cannot determine Mr. Thielson's state of mind based upon the record. I think it's important that when you look at November 12th, Mr. Thielson woke up in the jail at 8 a.m., took a shower, arrived at the Brown County Courthouse probably somewhere around 9. That time I do not have exactly. From 9 until 9:46, he was in a room with his wife talking with his defense counsel. The private conference, which there is a transcript of in the record, began at 9:46 and was done at 10:02. We're talking about 16 minutes. From 10:02 to 10:40, Mr. Thielson was left in a conference room with his wife. At 10:40, he went into the first hearing in front of Judge Von Wall. That hearing lasted 13 minutes until 10:53. That's also recorded on a transcript. At 10:53, he was back into that room with his wife, discussing things with her, talking with her. His defense team in and out in that time, preparing the factual basis, bringing the paperwork for him to sign. Court was recessed until 2:10, pardon me, in the afternoon, for the entering of the factual basis, the entering of his plea to these charges. That hearing lasted 10 minutes from 2:10 to 2:20. Now between 2:20 at the end of that hearing, actually between 9 a.m. roughly when he arrived at the courthouse and 2:20 when that hearing was over, we have transcripts that cover about 39 minutes. That leaves over 3 hours of time in which he was having discussions with his wife, with his defense attorneys, those are the discussions that helped frame his point of view, his mental state at that time. Yes, my reply brief did say it's frivolous. It is tough to determine. It's difficult to determine what an individual's state of mind is based solely on 39 minutes of recorded transcripts. The state mentioned self-serving testimony in the way of saying yes. A review of that record will show that the defendant made 36 responses in that hearing. 34 of them were one or two word variations of yes to leading questions. That's what he had to offer. Yes, what I really want to remind is that, and the state touched on this also, the six reasons which this court determined State versus Grosch, or Grosch, I might have said that wrong, of what should be examined in determining whether or not a plea can be withdrawn. An assertion of innocence. Mr. Thielson has asserted his innocence. An assertion that the plea is contrary to the truth. By asserting his innocence, the plea is automatically contrary to the truth, according to his version. An assertion of the misapprehension of facts. In a way, he did misapprehend the facts in that he was not thinking clearly when he entered the plea agreement. An assertion of receipt of incorrect advice. His motion to dismiss his defense team, his assertions that they were not working to their utmost for his benefit, is a receipt of incorrect advice. An assertion of a misunderstanding of the plea's effect or a misconception of the nature of the charges. That does not apply here. And finally, an assertion that the plea was procured by fraud, mistake, misapprehension, fear, or improper means. Mr. Thielson contends that he was under mental distress and entered this plea by mistake.
What facts do you claim he misapprehended?
Misapprehension of the facts is that he was not clearly thinking about what he was pleading to. While Mr. Thielson would view the charges against him and know that some he did, he has maintained throughout this that he was not the individual who killed Kelly Ryan. The misapprehension of the facts would be that he was looking more at the potent, listening to his defense counsel and their assertion that to go on with a jury trial would ultimately result in a death penalty for him, or worst case scenario, be found guilty of so many instances and the years would add up to over life in prison. You might as well take this off.
Well, if those are the facts, what's his misapprehension about him?
His misapprehension was that would be that he was not in a clear state of mind when he listened to them, and probably probably would have been more apt to accept a plea agreement that did not include a plea to the guilty charge, in that he has maintained that he did not commit the crime of murder.
Did he maintain his innocence of the rape charge?
He has maintained that there is question there also, that it was more of a consensual basis, although that has never been explored fully. But that is Mr. Thielson's stand on the issue, is that it was not rape. I guess in closing, this court has said in the past that a motion to withdraw should be liberally construed in favor of the movement. Mr. Thielson did abide by the rules. His motion was offered prior to sentencing. It did not show prejudice to the state. The totality of the circumstances, while not properly articulated by Mr. Thielson at the plea hearing, are such that he was in a mental state that did not allow him to enter this plea with all of his faculties intact, or not thinking clearly at the time due to his circumstances of mental and physical stress and duress that he was under leading up to it. And in that, Mr. Thielson would ask that this court reverse and remand and allow him another chance at trial.
Okay. On both charges or on just the murder charge?
On the whole thing.
Okay.
Let me ask another question.
Sure. How much advance notice did defense counsel have of his pro se request to withdraw his plea?
My understanding is that they were informed of it on the 20th, I believe. The hearing was on the 21st.
So they did have some advance notice?
Just a little bit. The evening of the 20th, I believe, is when they heard that he was filing the motions.
And did they prepare for the motion?
I can't answer that. I haven't talked to them about that issue.
Is there any evidence in the record that they prepared for the motion?
There was some testimony or some statements made by, I believe, Mr. Gerdes, and I believe also Mr. Vanderlinden, making some arguments in support of the motions. So I would assume, based on those, a